Weather forecast. Well, we got some clouds today, a high of 35, a wind chill value of negative 8. That's this afternoon. But tonight, a low will be down to around 10. The snow, yes, that's going to play a role here, but also the cold temperatures as we move into Tuesday. Temperatures will be at a high of 19 on Tuesday. Wednesday, 2 above. On Wednesday night, we could see temperatures go down to negative 10 degrees. So keep warm, bundle up. 24 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Year Bank studios. Next Year Bank, it's your hometown community bank. Your news time is just about 12:30. Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us, and have a good day.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, as you just heard Tracy saying, we've rocketed all the way up to the upper 20s. And we're looking at 35 later this afternoon, briefly. Don't get used to it. It's going to get bitterly cold again. It was cold this morning. We had zero here in the city of Butler, and that's in the city. That's pretty unusual. In another day or two, we're going to be down below zero, so hang on. Well, it's good book reading weather, and that's what we're going to talk about on the It's Your Turn program today. It's a book talk day. We welcome Kathy Klein, who's here representing the Shakora Area Community Library today. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And the book that you've selected to discuss is called The Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty.
Yes.
I had not heard of the book. It's not a new book. It's, what, 5-6 years old, I guess.
I believe it was published in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I actually overheard a couple patrons kind of discussing this particular book, and then the Shakora book group chose it to read, and it was just by chance I couldn't participate, but I was listening to just snippets of conversation, and I thought, I think I need to read this book. So I ended up taking it home, and I don't know about you, but whenever I started reading it, I started it like a Saturday afternoon, and I literally could not put it down. I know I was done by Sunday evening.
Well, you read fast because it's a long book.
But it was like, okay, I couldn't wait. I had to find out what the heck is going on.
It's almost 400 pages.
Yeah, well, and what was happening, I don't know with you, but for me, starting out, I thought, okay, this is going to get a little too many characters. You know, so that's why I kept right, because in my mind I had to put them in their place, you know, to get this story going.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got them set in motion in my brain, so to speak, it just really started resonating with me.
Well, I must tell you that I did not think I was going to like it.
Ah.
When I heard the title, The Husband's Secret, it sounded like a book that was written for women.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, it sounded like a romance.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, you know, that's chosen every once in a while for a book
talk. I make you read anything.
Well, and that's fine. You know, I mean, I've read some romances mm-hmm. for a book talk. And I thought, well, okay. So I started it, and it's not a romance. It's a fiction novel.
It's kind of a mystery. I want to say like a little bit of a thriller, or a little psychology. It's a little bit of everything.
The main characters, however, are all women. There's no question about that.
But there's more to the story. There are men. There's families. There's a community. You know, that makes up this whole story. You know, it's just the community that these women grew up in, lived in, came back to, wherever the story, you know, brings them. And I remember at the end of the book and looking at the front cover thinking, you know, I wish they would have put a different cover on this book. Because even the way it's packaged, I agree with you, David. It looks like a woman's read only.
Yes, that was my thought. Well, I'll slog through this. But I found it intriguing. It's not the best book I've ever read. I don't mean to say that, but it was it was intriguing. You wanted to know what happened. First of all, it's set in Australia, when I don't actually recall ever reading another novel that was set in Australia.
I don't know either, but, you know, whenever I had to literally go back and review to remember where the story took place, because in my mind, I thought this was the kind of story that could happen anywhere in the world.
Possible. Western world, anyway, because these are... there's three women in particular who are the focus, and they're, you know, middle class, present day Australia. I had to do some calculating to find out exactly when it was set, and I came up with 2012, which makes sense because the book was published in 2013.
Correct.
I was just, the author, Leanne Moriarty, never actually said that, but by, you know, extrapolating from dates that were given, who was this, who was how old this time, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right, because some of the characters were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are grown, you know, have professions, whatnot. So you have to do a little calculating, yeah.
Well, let's talk about these three main characters, the three women around whom this whole story revolves. Woman number one, Cecilia Fitzpatrick.
Fitzpatrick, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Cecilia is married to John Paul, and I believe that both of them were longtime residents of Sydney and grew up in the community, went to school together.
I was wondering when I saw his name, is that typical in Australia to have a guy with two names? I mean, you know, like...
I don't know.
Like Jim Bob or Billy Bob in the American South.
I don't know. They call him John Paul.
John Paul.
Yeah. I don't know. I know it's hyphenated in the story, you know. That's because it's always made reference to as John Paul, you know. So I don't know. But Cecilia is very involved in the community. She, I think, is a young lady who likes to stay very focused on the task at hand.
She's extremely organized.
Yes. And not to mention the best Tupperware representative in the community.
Tupperware consultant.
Yes.
I didn't know they had Tupperware in Australia, but obviously they do.
Mm-hmm.
She's in her early 40s, 42, I believe, and mm-hmm. she thinks of herself as ordinary, the typical suburban mom, because she has three daughters.
She's got three daughters, Isabel, Esther, and Polly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Isabel is the oldest at 12, Esther is 10, and Polly is 6,
mm-hmm.
the baby of the family.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she does. She does not see herself as really accomplishing much, I don't think, in her life so far. That she's pretty typical, you know, and at one point I think I remember her comparing herself to some of her other classmates and what they have gone on to do, and that she is, you know, your typical mom.
She is so organized, though, she actually keeps lists of things that she has to do on her iPhone app.
Yes.
One of her daughters was Esther, I believe, had been studying the Berlin Wall in school, or reading. She had a book about the Berlin Wall, and Cecilia, in her past life, when she was in her late teens or around 20 years old, had been in Germany, and actually had a piece of it because it was at the time that the wall was being torn down. So she put a note on her iPhone app, find a piece of Berlin Wall for E.
Mm-hmm. And Esther, I loved Esther, her middle child, because to me, Esther was the type of child as she wanted to know. You know, she would go from topic to topic, and she would want to know everything about it before she was ready to move on to another subject. And a lot of it was history.
Well, the Berlin Wall was the latest. She had graduated from the Titanic.
Yes.
And earlier from dinosaurs, which apparently amused and entranced kids all over the world. Certainly did here in the U.S. and in Australia as well. But Cecilia actually had a little chunk of rock.
She did.
That she had purchased when she was in Berlin from somebody who was hawking pieces of the wall.
Mm-hmm. And like she, I think at one point she said, well, she doesn't really know if it came from the wall, but they sold it as coming from the wall, so, you know.
She said it actually looked like a rock that could have come from anywhere. But anyway, she made a note on her iPad to go up in the attic because she had had souvenirs up there, and she wanted to get this so she could give it to Esther. So she was intrigued by the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall is a theme that is threaded throughout this entire novel in many different ways. Mm-hmm. But that's the first time you hear of it whenever her daughter asks her about the Berlin Wall. There's one other thing about Cecilia that we have to talk about straight away. She, well, it's actually when she goes up into the attic to find the piece of the rock, she accidentally knocks over a pile of shoeboxes of her husband, and a letter falls out that says, "To my wife, Cecilia, to be opened only in the event of my death." It's a sealed letter.
Yeah, see, I think that this is what's at the heart of this story. It's this letter that's not meant to be read, which, as the story evolves, I kind of saw it like as the Pandora's box, because once, and if it's open, it's going to generate many issues, problems, whatever you want to call it, for multiple people.
The book actually opens, and I made a note of this because it mentions Pandora from mythology, and Zeus sends her off to marry somebody along with a mysterious, it says, a mysterious covered jar.
Yes.
And she was not supposed to open the jar. I always thought it was a box, you know, and when I read mythology, it was Pandora's box. It wasn't Pandora's jar.
Why do we call it Pandora's box if it was a jar?
Well, why does she call it a jar if it was a box?
That's true.
I wanted to know.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a preface to the whole novel. And
you learned that very early in the novel. That's what I think the driving for me it was, the driving force.
Well, it refers to secrets, and you know the whole novel is about secrets in the lives of all of these three women. So that's Cecilia. I have to look at my notes to remember. Some of them lived in Sydney, and some of them lived in Melbourne. By the way, Melbourne was the Australian Open was in Melbourne for the past 2 weeks. I found that quite the coincidence as I was reading this book. You know, the big tennis tournament was in Melbourne, wrapped up yesterday. Well, anyway, let's move on to the second of the three women who are mentioned. By the way, the first three chapters of the book talk about these three women sequentially. You learn about Cecilia, whom we just talked about. And then we learn about Tess Curtis.
Tess and Will, yes. Tess and Will actually have a business with Tess's cousin, Felicity.
Mm-hmm. Will's her husband, by the way.
Yes, Will was her husband.
Will and Tess.
Yeah, Curtis. And they have an advertising business in Melbourne, I think, at TWF.
Tess, Will, and Felicity.
That's what I figured it stood for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so and they have a son, Liam, and
young kid, 6.
Yes, yes. And Felicity ultimately ends up interfering with their relationship, and that she ultimately ends up becoming the other woman.
Well, Felicity is Tessa's cousin.
Yes.
Although, actually, as Leanne Moriarty writes, they were more like sisters.
They did, because their mothers were twin sisters. Mm-hmm. And I think that Tess was an only child, as was Felicity.
And they were about the same age, and they lived close to each other, and so they were kind
it would
of
only
like
be
sisters.
Very close.
So that's why it became an absolute crusher to Tess whenever Will told her one night, we have to talk about something. Guess what? Felicity and I have fallen in love.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the three of them, I think, were... I think their business was downstairs... Yeah. In a basement or something.
Kind of bizarre. The
Tess and Will's home
business was
something.
In the basement of the house.
Yes, yeah. She was invited down there by, I believe it was, Will and Felicity. And the two of them kind of broke this news to her. And I believe whenever they brought it to her attention, they had, the affair had already, well, I don't, do you call it an affair or don't you call it an affair? I don't know. They had, for like 6 months.
The appropriate thing is we've fallen in love.
Yes. Yes. That they had fallen in love with one another. And this had been going on for about 6 months.
Well, that was about the time that Felicity had joined Weight Watchers and lost a lot of weight.
Yes.
And had become, at least in Tess's eyes, beautiful.
Yes. Yes, she did well. And I don't... There's a lot that goes on in between, I think, Tess and Felicity, as far as insecurities and insecurities and in supporting one another. And I felt that Tess never felt Felicity was much of a threat to her, as far as, you know, in the romance field, until she lost this weight. And then I don't think she even saw it as a threat until this was brought to her attention. Obviously, Will found her very attractive, too.
Let's move on to the third of these women who is older than the first two, Cecilia and Tess. The third woman is Rachel Crowley,
yes,
who lives in... Sydney, she is a widowed and very interfering grandmother to our grandson, Jacob.
She is.
He's a little, he's like a toddler, I don't know, 3 years old or something like that.
Two or three, yeah, yeah. And she has very much devoted the last 2 or 3 years, you know, to Jacob.
Why do you think that is?
He has, I think he probably filled a void for her. Because another crux of the story, you know, is Rachel had a daughter, Janie.
Who was murdered.
Yes. Who was murdered.
Age 17.
Yes. And in 1984, I believe that it was. And they never found out who the culprit was. Who,
yeah, the murder was never, the murder, murder was never solved. Yeah. She was found dead in a park.
Yes. Yeah. Never... was really never resolved. So Rachel, all these years, had, I think, was a very, living with a lot of anguish that her daughter's murder had never been found, although she had assumptions of her own.
Well, she had a son. His name was Rob. And at the time of the action and the... around 2012, he was married. Daughter-in-law was Lauren, and they had this boy, Jacob. I felt that she was so attached to Jacob because, A, she didn't like the daughter-in-law, Lauren, and, B, she felt guilty that, you know, after the death of Janie, she didn't pay much attention to Rob. She felt kind of guilty about that.
And, yeah, I mean, that could be possible. And I thought, I mean, when I was reading that, this was a woman that through the years, you know, living in all this anguish and what's she going to do with her life and reliving, you know, the murder of her daughter over and over. And that's kind of been a focus, you know, of her life. And you're right. I think she left everything else go by the wayside. But whenever Jacob was born... You know, he helped her to fill the hours where she would be obsessing because she took care of him, you know, and he gravitated toward her. And so I thought that she used him as filling a void that was, you know, in her life.
We're talking on Book Talk here today about a novel by Leanne Moriarty. The title is The Husband's Secret. We'll take a break and we'll come back and continue our conversation here on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR right after this one message.
If you're thinking about buying a car, truck, or SUV, or even if you just bought one, make sure you check out the great rates at Armco Credit Union. Through February 28th, you can get a 60-month loan on new and used vehicles for as low as 2.24 annual percentage rate. We'll even refinance your loan from another financial institution. It's never been easier to join, so call today for other rates and terms or visit us at armcocu.com to become a member. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome back. Kathy Klein is our guest, representing the Shikora Community Library, and we're talking on Book Talk today about The Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty. By the way, a New York Times bestseller and a bestseller in the United Kingdom as well, which I guess is understandable since she's from Australia.
Australia.
Lives in Australia. Yeah. Lives in Sydney, I believe.
Yes. This is the first book of hers that I personally have read. I know that she has picked up in popularity as I saw more of her titles and requests, you know, coming into the library.
I'd never heard of her before.
Yeah. And I think she has maybe a dozen or so books that she has written, but this is the first that I have read of hers. I wouldn't hesitate to read something else of hers.
By the way, this takes place, and this was a little bit disconcerting because, of course, I knew that the seasons were reversed in Australia. You know, they're in the middle of summer right now, and while we're in the middle of winter, as I mentioned, they just played the big tennis tournament down in Melbourne. But this entire novel takes place in just 6 days.
Amazing.
From the Monday before Easter up through Easter Sunday. So it's 1 week. And the first time she talked about the glorious color of the fall foliage at Easter time, I thought, what? And then I realized.
I did the same thing.
Well,
yeah.
That's right. You know, yeah. Easter for us is springtime, but Easter on Australia is autumn, you know.
Yeah.
It's getting colder, and the leaves are turning and starting to fall, and
yep,
that would be difficult to deal with, I think. Well, unless you were a native Australian, and of course she is. So, yeah, the whole thing takes place in 6 days.
It does. And there's a lot of action in those 6 days, you know, as far as I found. I think what I really liked about this book and it has a great balance of internal and external conflicts that moves and keeps this story moving forward so that you have your characters that are struggling within. She shares that with you, but she doesn't dwell on it. And then there's something externally in the story that moves it along. You know, so I think for me, that's what I found such a quick read.
Everyone in this, all of these characters have some sort of a phobia, which struck me as a little bit unbelievable. Maybe a couple of them, but everybody, you know, John Paul,
Cecilia's
wife is claustrophobic.
Yeah.
He has nightmares about walls closing in on him. Will, that's Tess's husband, is having a midlife crisis. Tess has had social anxiety even when she was a young girl. So everybody has some sort of a phobia, and everybody has secrets. We're back
they
to Pandora's
do.
Box here.
They do. What's striking is that everybody's secrets, I think, all stem back to 1984 in that one day. Whenever
Janie was
murdered, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are major themes in this book. Certainly one of them is grief, whether it's over the loss of a child or the loss of a husband or the loss of a marriage.
Yeah. And the other one for me, I felt, was guilt. An awful lot of characters, because of the circumstances of this story, had lived the bulk of their life up until this time, dealing with guilt.
Do you think that was fair?
For one character, sure.
I do for many of them.
Yes. And
they all should have felt guilty.
Well, and as the story kind of evolved, you know, you learn of, we'll say, a new guilt from another character, because you don't find that out right away, that all of these characters that are dealing, you know, with the guilt. Now, the only one is Tess. I don't remember a guilt that Tess would have.
I'm thinking earlier,
but you're absolutely right. It would be afterwards, but she found it justifiable, did she not? Because of the situation with Will and Felicity, you know, so she, and it was with, an old boyfriend, but that would happen to be the physical education teacher at,
St. Angela's School.
St. Angela's School, which I found this school also, I got the sense that this school was the center of a lot of folks in the communities, you know, their lives, as a lot of our schools even, you know, here do. You know, it's focused around the school, but that it's at the school where all of these characters, the women, meet for the first time.
I found it difficult once I got past the first few chapters, whenever they were just explaining who these three main women were. I got mixed up. You know, there were just too many people, and I couldn't remember who was married to who and who was sleeping with who and whatever. Did you have that too?
I did, and we are not alone in that, David, because I know a couple of my ladies from the book club, literally, as they were reading, said they started jotting things down.
Well, you'd have to. I mean, otherwise you couldn't keep it straight.
Right, but once you did get it straight, then it flowed. But I think the first third part of the book, yeah, I was always reaching back in my mind, okay, now who is this? Yeah.
Well, the first three chapters just dealt with the women individually. First there was Cecilia, and then there was mm-hmm. Tess, and then there was Rachel. But then they started, and by the way, the lives of all of these women, as it turns out, are intertwined, which I kind of guessed in the beginning. And that's when it gets really complex, because, you know, a couple of the kids go to school at St. Angela's. One of the women is a secretary there. That's the grandmother, Rachel. And the other woman is going to take her kid there to get him. So, you know, it all comes winding together here.
Yeah,
in fact, it gets more complex than that a little bit later on with boyfriends and ex-husbands and everything else.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found myself when I was reading after the three women were introduced and the story started moving, I mean, I guess in my mind's eye, when they would have those interactions, I'm thinking, okay, she is literally taking all of these three women and their lives, because that's where all those other characters come into play. And I could sense as the I always want to say movie, because when I'm reading, I'm seeing it as a movie. But as the story progresses, I see them coming closer and closer and closer together, and the interaction where, of course, toward the end of the story, they're all there.
I'm surprised it hasn't been made into a movie. I think it'd make a good, better movie than Gone Girl, which I thought was horrible.
Yeah.
The Gillian Flynn novel.
I agree 100%.
I didn't like the book. We had it for book talk, by the way, several years ago. Yeah. And then the movie came out. I wouldn't even have dreamed of going to see the movie because I didn't like the book.
No, I didn't. In fact, I don't know that I finished watching the movie. I read the book. And I thought, well, maybe the movie would be a little, which doesn't typically work for me. Usually, you know, the book is always better. But I thought, well, maybe the movie will be better on this one. The only book that I ever read that I thought the movie was better was The English Patient. And I read the book and I thought, oh, that it was like all over the place. But when I saw the movie, it came together for me.
It's a long time ago. Ralph Fiennes, wasn't it? Ralph Fiennes, the English Patient, I think.
And that. So, but no, Gone Girl, I couldn't even finish watching it. And that I just kind of got discouraged with it.
Another theme that runs throughout this book, in addition to grief and guilt, is ethics, morals, yes. Betrayal, because that pops up quite a bit.
Yeah, and basically, for me, it came down to right and wrong. You know, what was the right thing to do versus doing the wrong thing. And then in the book club group, we played the, well, what if this happened? I mean, what would you do? And that, because you're dealing with people that you love, that are your family, and would you right away step up and do the right thing?
What would you do if you found a sealed envelope addressed to you, and it was to be opened only in the event of the death of your spouse? That's what happened to Cecilia. By the way, when she finds this thing, her husband is in Chicago.
He is.
Halfway around the world on a business trip. And he calls. He calls every day.
He would call every evening, yes.
And she casually mentions that she found this envelope, and he just,
dead silence on the other end.
He's horrified because he obviously knows what's in there.
Yeah.
And he says, don't open it, don't open it, don't open it. Well, what would you do?
Well, and then he comes home 3 days early, Annette, from his business trip. You know, so it's like, well, okay, what's in this letter? I would need to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, he wants to get it.
And, he does.
He fakes like he doesn't, as I recall. And then one night she wakes up in the middle of the night and she hears something up in the attic, and she realizes it's him up there, honey, because she told him she had put it back in the shoebox.
Yes.
Unopened.
Yes.
And he was up there trying to find it. And, of course, she didn't really put it there.
No,
she put
it was
in
his
desk or somewhere.
It was in his office in the desk or something
And when she heard him up in the attic, rooting around, that's when she got up, got the letter opener, and opened the letter and read it right there on the spot.
Yeah. She read it real fast, and then I remember she then went back and she reread it word for word for word.
Well, this would be the first big shocker, I think, in this book, because in the letter, John Paul, her husband, confessed to murdering Janie.
Yes.
Rachel's daughter.
Yes.
Boing.
Yes. And I think once he explained it to her, and I'm not justifying it because Janie lost her life. And when he explained it to her, in my mind, I never saw it again as a murder. I saw it as an accidental death. Because when he explained to her, that of course he lost his temper and, had
started
his hands,
choking her.
Started choking her, but he says there's no way he could have had, his hands around her neck that long that would have caused her death. But indeed, she did die, So it wasn't something that he intended to do at 17 years old.
Yeah, this would have been almost 30 years before the action of
exactly.
the novel takes place.
Yeah.
She was a teenager.
Yes. Yeah, he was a teenager. She was a teenager.
Well, it was a love triangle thing. She told him she wanted to break up with him, and she was going to go with somebody else.
Connor.
Connor Whitby. And he got mad and started to choke her.
Well, she laughed at him.
Is that a reason to start choking
somebody?
No, it's not.
But at 17, like I said, this is where his anger came from. Because he typically was not an angry, violent person. But when he thought they were getting together, because I think he was expecting her to commit to being his girlfriend, and then actually she was coming to say that they weren't. Because remember, nobody knew that they had been seeing one another. Because they would meet. This is why they were in the park. And that they were meeting in the park. And it happened to be just the opposite of what he was expecting. And so he had said, I think at that conversation, he had mentioned to her that he had loved her, or he thought they were going to be boyfriend, girlfriend, and she laughed at him, and that's when he lost his temper.
Well, this is when it started to get a little bit too complex for me to follow, because the new boyfriend not John Paul. He was being tossed under the bus.
Yes.
The new boyfriend was Connor Whitby, who happened to be the individual that Tess Curtis had the affair with whenever she found out about her husband and her cousin.
Yes, you have to remember, Connor was...
Is your head starting to spin yet, folks?
And Connor actually was a little older than your high school. He was children, and then he was even older than Tess whenever, you know, Tess. He was about, seems to me I remember he was 10 years older than Tess whenever she had dated him when they were in school. And then Felicity, you know, of course, Tess and her were, you know, connected at the hip. She mentioned to Tess at the very beginning that to kind of dump him, get rid of him, you know. But Tess really liked him and that. But he comes into the picture, too, because he's the one that Janie ultimately decides she's going to declare as her boyfriend. So, this is where the confrontation was with John Paul earlier, and of course, they don't go into too much as to what Connor was thinking or feeling the day of her murder, other than he was the last person that saw Janie, and that's what the that fact is what made Rachel, who is Janie's mom, think that Connor is the one who is responsible for her murder.
Well, as I said, I found this book intriguing, but when I got to this stage, there were just too many coincidences that popped up. I thought the plot got too complex. And, you know, I'm kind of shaking my head because the only reason that Rachel suspected this Connor guy of killing her daughter was because she found a videotape.
Well, that was later on the show. She thought that was proof positive.
Yeah.
That he is the one who murdered her daughter.
Meanwhile, John Paul had already confessed to his wife that he had murdered her.
Yes. But these are all the
I'm a little confused here. I told you. It was too many coincidences.
Well, these are all of the secrets, how I interpreted. These are all of the secrets that all of these characters had kept all these years. So now, as we're reading, these secrets are starting to be shared with, whether it be the significant other or an important person, you know, in their life, so that you find how convoluted and crazy, and it's not a wonder that maybe her murderer was truly never found. And I found it eye-opening, I guess, that all of these secrets that all of these characters had, if John Paul would have told the truth, all of these secrets certainly, you know, wouldn't be there. And a lot of the guilt and the anguish that people had lived with would not have had to live with if he would have just stepped up to tell the truth.
Next coincidence that left me going, oh, come on, really. When Tess decides to suddenly leave, take their 6-year-old son and leave Will, conveniently, her mother has just broken her ankle. In Sydney, so she books a flight that night and takes the little kid, and they go off to Sydney to care for her mother. Well, how convenient that her mother broke her ankle.
Well, her mother,
just in time for this. How perfect that is.
Well, I think it had been shared that her mother had broken her ankle prior to that, and I think that Tess took that opportunity. You know, the opportunity was there, so she took it. What I found more astonishing, I guess, is that she took Liam and went back to her mother's because she said to Will and Felicity, okay, you guys just need to have a real affair. So she was leaving, anticipating that they indeed, and then they would just get over one another. Yeah.
It started to go downhill for me there. As I said, though, I did find this book intriguing, but for some other reasons. Let us take a break here, and we'll come back and talk about some of those in just a moment. It's Book Talk here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR for a frosty Monday. We'll be back right after this.
Olivia from Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that Mommy and Daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back. We're talking about Leanne Moriarty's novel, The Husband's Secret. And, I'm looking at the cover of the book again. It's Husband's apostrophe S. It should be S apostrophe, shouldn't it? We've got a lot of secrets
well,
in here.
I think that we do have a lot of secrets, but I think the focus of the story is the one husband's,
John Paul's
secret. Okay. Because all of those other secrets, other than Tess's, sometimes I think is a trickle-down effect in that from John Paul's major secret.
One of the other themes that I thought runs through this book, the issue of parenting and how divorce has an effect on children. Tessa's parents had divorced when she was a child, and that's why she was
so
worried about her little boy.
She was determined. Yeah, she was determined that the same thing was not going to happen to Liam.
And somebody's parents had divorced too. I don't know. By this point, I had names coming out of my eyeballs: Mary, Lucy. Was that the twin mothers, Mary and Lucy? Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And one set of them was divorced.
And
do you remember?
It's almost like a little Peyton Place. Do you remember?
It is a little Peyton Place in Australia.
Do you remember? Because Rachel, the murdered girl's mother, who was the school secretary at St. Angela's. She was there part-time. Do you remember who the other part-time secretary was that she shared the responsibilities with?
I do not, no.
It happened to be Virginia Fitzpatrick, which was John Paul's mother. And so I thought, whoa, you know, that's when it really started. I really had to start writing things down.
By the way, there was one other intertwining that we haven't mentioned yet. And again, I'm rolling my eyeballs here because I thought this could have been a successful novel with one third of all these connections. I just thought it became too, too unbelievable. One of Cecilia's daughters, Polly, was hit by a car, driven, of course, by one of the other women, by Rachel, I believe it was.
Yes, yes.
And she lost an arm or something like that. It was a very serious accident.
Yes. And, you know, what prompted her to run out into the street was because Polly, as young as she was, which is, I think, typical of a lot of children, that they have crushes on their teachers. And she had this little infatuation going on with her physical education teacher.
Oh, no, not him again.
Yes, which happened to be Connor. Connor Whitby, who was the one that Rachel thought all along, all these years, is the one who murdered her daughter.
Yeah. As I told you, it started to be a comedy for me because there were just too many, you know, coincidental interconnections. A couple of them would have worked, but I thought there were just too many.
Yeah. I think life is complicated, though. And I didn't find it beyond unbelievable, I guess, simply because the characters and everything that she created and in this community, a lot our readers can relate to, you know, what they do with their lives, you know, the involvement in their school or in their churches, Tupperware. I mean, nothing is more, you know, come into my house than a Tupperware representative, you know, women can relate to, although this is not, as you said earlier, a woman's read. But
did you know they had Tupperware in Australia? Tupperware parties?
I did not know, but it didn't surprise me.
I didn't either. Another theme that runs through this book is a TV show called The Biggest Loser.
Yes.
Is that still on? I have no idea.
I don't know if it is or not. I was never a fan of The Biggest Loser.
I never watched it. I saw the promos when it was on. I haven't seen them recently. That's
why I
suspect
that it's not on.
Yeah, every
household seemed to be watching The Biggest Loser.
And it was in Australia, too, for goodness
sakes.
Yes.
Yeah, unless there was nothing else on television. I don't know.
But it would. This popped up throughout the book, just like the Berlin Wall. What do you think the significance of the Berlin Wall popping up all the time? Much more than just the one kid, you know, reading about it in school.
Well, I don't know. For me, it was, okay, we had the Berlin Wall, and everybody had walls personally put up around them. Mm-hmm. And as the story progressed, those walls came down. Might not have been pleasant, but those walls came down. And if you think about even whenever, you know, the Berlin Wall itself came down. When was that? In the late 80s? I can't remember.
Well, it went up in the early 60s.
So about 88 or 89, I think, is when the wall came down. And even when the wall came down, it was not, there was chaos. It was not something that was, you know, organized and it was taken down brick by brick. There was chaos. And I just think that the walls that the people had put up around them, which definitely, if anybody put up walls, it was Rachel. I think that she did a great injustice to her daughter-in-law. In fact, I don't think any of the characters who had the daughter-in-laws really, I think they held them at arm's length. You know, Rachel, you know, held off Lauren. I mean, and I think Lauren tried her very best to be a friend to her mother-in-law, the same way with Cecilia, you know. And I mean, I know everyone has issues with their mother-in-law, but I think they really took it to the extremes, you know. And she definitely put up walls. Rachel did, especially Rachel.
This book, the testimonial reviews, you know, the quick blurbs that are on the back of the book, most of them were from women writers. One, though, was from Kirkus Reviews, which I respect a great deal. And Kirkus said, quote, "Moriarty may be an edgier, more provocative, and a bolder successor to Maeve Binchy, the late Irish writer." So that's pretty good testimonial there.
Absolutely.
Especially from Kirkus Reviews.
Yes.
And Parade Magazine liked it, too.
Yes.
That's the Sunday newspaper magazine every Sunday. I liked the way she wrote. As I said before, I thought there were far too many coincidences and just it got to two. These lives became too intertwined. But I liked the way Leanne Moriarty wrote. She, you know, in trying to describe the lives of these, you know, typical middle class, you know, most of them middle aged, Rachel a little bit older, women. Well, I just thought her writing was excellent. One thing that I actually wrote down, she was talking about Rachel. This is the widowed, interfering grandmother with the little toddler from her son and daughter-in-law, Jacob. part of the plot line is that the son and daughter come to see her. She thinks they're going to say that they're, you know, going to be having another child, and instead, Rob says, Lauren got a job in New York, and we're moving to New York for 2 years.
Yes, she was the very professional woman, mm-hmm. Lauren was.
And she, she was a career woman. And, of course, that meant that she wouldn't have the little toddler around for a while. And the phrase that Leanne wrote, Rachel thought that we move, her life was a pile of cards, a stack of cards, and we moved the Jacob card and her life collapsed. It's a nice turn of a phrase.
Exactly. And now that you mentioned that, it reminded me, too, that when we were talking about walls, and I said about how Rachel had put up that wall, and I think a prime example of how Rachel's wall was coming down was by the end of the book, when a lot of stuff has been revealed. She then says, oh, I suppose going to New York would not be that big of a trip. And she has lowered her guard a little, and that she is contemplating that when they are in New York City, that she could come, because and her and Rob talk about the different places that they might visit whenever they are in the United States.
Not that big of a trip. You couldn't get any further away.
From
Australia to New York, I mean, whether you flew east or west.
Well, I don't think she was meaning by miles. I was thinking the possibility of going there, where before it was absolutely not. She couldn't, you know. And it's because she didn't want Jacob to go.
I thought the biggest theme of this book, and it was a good one, I thought, despite my reservations, was the question, what if?
Yes.
And hasn't everybody thought that in their life? What if I'd have been 5 minutes later, you know, at some point in your life, would I not have met this person? Have been involved in this auto
Rachel
accident?
Plays that. You remember Rachel playing that game, because the day that Janie was murdered, she was to meet her to pick her up to take her for a doctor's appointment, because Janie had been having some issues, and they needed to get to the bottom of it. And she was 5 minutes late. And multiple times throughout the story, Rachel was saying, what if I hadn't been late? What if I hadn't, you know? And her whole life up until this point, beating herself up because she had been 5 minutes late. And then, of course, as the story progresses, her not knowing that Janie had forgotten all about the doctor's appointment and wasn't there anyway. You know, so you do play that what if game.
What if? What if?
Mm-hmm.
What about secrets? Don't you think everybody has secrets from their life that they don't share with other people?
Oh, I think so. Whether they're grand secrets or whether they're secrets, I think everybody has secrets.
Is that good or bad? Aren't there some secrets that maybe should not be shared?
I think that if you have a secret that ultimately is going to hurt other people, maybe it's best to keep that secret to yourself. But by not sharing that secret, if it ultimately hurts many people, I think it's best to share that secret. Because look, I mean, that's the biggest thing I saw with John Paul. That if he had gone and he had gone to the police even at 17, or his mother, and remember when they found Janie, the rosary beads that were in her hand? Do you remember whose rosary beads those were?
I do not.
John Paul's mother's.
There's another mother. I had enough with Lucy and Mary and everybody else.
But if John Paul,
I couldn't keep him straight.
But whenever Cecilia asked John Paul, why didn't you go and well, if they had come knocking at my door, I was going to. But they had not captured anybody. They had no clues. They had no idea who had murdered Janie. But he says, well, if they had come to my door, I would have confessed. Well, what if they would have arrested Connor, which everybody pretty much knew that Rachel felt Connor is the one who had murdered her? Well, I wouldn't have left him go. So he sat back and he waited and waited and waited, and nothing happened. But look at all the anguish and the guilt that he lived with his whole life. And then by him not sharing the truth, how it affected him and his relationship, how it affected Rachel, the anguish and the guilt. Connor, the guy who, you know, Rachel and some of the community, you know, had blamed it on. I mean, all of that hurt and anguish and guilt that everybody suffered because John Paul did not tell the truth, for what the courage. And then, too, you know who I found I was really infuriated with was his mother. She knew those rosary beads were hers. She knew that he had to have been in that park with Janie.
Ah, but perhaps all is not what it seems. Some final thoughts after this final break here on the Book Talk on It's Your Turn. We'll be right back.
They have spent a lifetime caring for others, and now the time has come for others to care for them. LifeSteps Adult Day Health Services, a trusted provider of senior care for over 30 years, can help. Families are comforted knowing their loved one will be safe, receive meals, be medically monitored, and enjoy socialization, all designed to enhance their life in a comfortable, relaxed setting. Free trial visits. Call LifeSteps today at 724-283-1010 or visit lifesteps.net.
The Butler County Symphony Orchestra will take you on a trip to Scandinavia this Saturday night in a concert entitled Nordic Winters. The symphony will take on classical works by Nilsson, Grieg, and Sibelius. The symphony will also be joined by nationally renowned pianist Stephen Boos. And all this week, you can get the Sweetheart Special, two tickets for only $35. Check butlersymphony.org for tickets or stop by the symphony office on the Diamond downtown and join the symphony this Saturday night, February 2nd, concert time 7 p.m. at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium for Nordic Winters.
Handling grief is tough and lonely. After the loss of a loved one, who can really understand how you feel, how grief affects your life every single day? Well, Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring. It's meticulously designed to help ease your emotional pain and help you fill in the gaps when you're lonely. Men and women are invited to attend. Yes, men too are realizing it's okay to express their feelings in a small group setting. Over the last 20 years, we've helped so many people work through their grief. We have five programs, a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. Our own trained and bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller, conducts each session personally. Call us at Thompson Miller, 724-287-3706, 287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Final thoughts. There was an epilogue to this book without revealing it. What did you think of the epilogue?
I loved it.
Didn't you?
I did. It reminded me of...
wrapped up a lot of loose ends, anyway.
It did.
Sometimes you finish a book and you say, what, so, you know.
Yeah, and they were... it was information that you did not, believe it or not, learn about in the gist of the story. And that it was little tidbit informations and, you know, it. And as I mentioned to you earlier, it reminded me a little bit of the ending of some of the episodes of The Twilight Zone with Rod Serling. And how he would give you...
Good point, yes.
He would give you these little bit... Well, if Marjorie would have known, you know, she might have made a different decision. You know, and that's kind of what that was the... Actually, that was my favorite part of the entire book. I love the book, but that was my favorite part of the entire story. Her wrapping up all of those... little coinky dinky little loose ends that you didn't know, you know, like I said, like for example, Rachel. That's where Rachel didn't know that Janie never kept that appointment at the corner to go to the doctor's, that she was feeling guilty for 30 years because she was 5 minutes late.
What if?
Yes.
Leanne Moriarty is the author. The Husband's Secret is the title, her fourth novel. I was not familiar with her until you selected it. It was a good pick, Kathy.
Thank you.
Yeah, good pick. Kathy Klein, representing the Shakora Community Library. Book talk next month will be on February 25th, the fourth Monday of the month. And, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes.
Well, there's an old story.
Yeah, it's an old one and a goodie.
Yes. Well, I'll be happy to. I don't think I've ever read the book. I've seen a couple of films on the Count of Monte Cristo. Zili Nopal Public Library will be here to talk about that at the tail end of February. Thank you, Kathy Klein.
Always my pleasure, and it's always fun.
That wraps up our It's Your Turn program today. Don't forget, Penguin Hockey is back tonight after a long all-star break, 6:30 airtime for warm-up here on WISR. Hope to see you tomorrow.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
And if you're wondering what this song